Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Well, the first thing that comes to mind, I'd like to say, is just the value of these, what we call rituals. Example, we come together like this and hear some teachings. And it is the case that, say, what you might hear, maybe something you've heard many, many, many times before. Maybe something you've thought about, you may have read it in books and so forth. And yet there's something about it, about being in a hall and the candles are lit and there's a room full of, say, monastics and lay practitioners sitting. And we did some chanting and meditation and the mind is just in a place, hopefully, where even relatively mundane truths that are still valuable, not to mention the more refined truths, they go to the heart more deeply and seem to carry more weight. So these kind of activities, things like this, or the one pra, the half moon observance days, these are really important things, important activities. Even though, say, as monastics, like, I mean, I've for 20 years now, since 22 years, I guess, since arriving at Nanachat way back when, you know, I've been listening to Dhamma talks like this once, twice a week at least. I remember Ajahn Jayasaro, one pansa, he made this determination to give a Dhamma talk every night. Every single night, he'd give a Dhamma talk. And you kind of eventually, part of you kind of, if you're not careful, you can kind of feel, here we go again. I've been through this, you know, a dozen times in the past couple of weeks. You feel almost, you know, you can feel kind of fed up with it. But just the very specialness, say, especially in a situation where you only hear once a week or once every, maybe a couple times a week, it's really valuable and it goes to the heart and it's something that's really worth caring for, this practice of regular listening to Dhamma. When we're new to Buddhism or to practice, you know, how is it? What is it that guides us to the Dhamma? What is it that guides us to deeper insight and understanding along the path? And it is going to be things like listening to Dhamma talks. It's going to be things like reading Dhamma and talking about it. And these are going to be the things that are going to cultivate the path. And this there's an insight in itself, just this much, that basically the Dhamma, it's a conditioned thing. The path is a conditioned thing. In fact, the Buddha says of all conditioned things in the world, the Eightfold Path is considered the highest. And of course, of all things conditioned and unconditioned, the Nibbana or freedom, complete liberation is considered the highest. But of the conditioned world, the Eightfold Path is the highest, so it's a conditioned thing. We find the path through cultivating certain conditions, and we lose it through cultivating certain conditions. And I think that's one of the things that speaks to me, anyways, very much so about Buddhism. The Buddha was very clear about the central role that causality plays in his teachings, and it comes up, and sometimes it can seem kind of cerebral. If you think about it, if you've come across something that's the most, say, worthwhile thing in the conditioned and the unconditioned, and you realize that there's a path that leads there, and you realize that the only way to make progress along the path is through condition, through causality, through doing the right causes. What an important thing to communicate to your disciples, you know, is that causality is the way that this path is going to unfold or collapse. So a very important condition is listening to the teachings, exposing yourself to the teachings, studying the teachings. And you do this, you have to bring the right attitude to studying and to study and to listening and all the rest of it, because just like words that are spoken on a night like this, say on an observance night, just like I said, they tend to go deeper than say the morning reflection that we do every day, even though that's also valuable in its own little way. But you hear it over and over every day, 5 days a week. But so one of the things that causes it to go deep into the heart, or deeper into the heart, on a situation like this is the little bit of formality around it, and the fact that it's a discipline. You know, we do this every Saturday, regardless of how we feel. And sometimes we'll come to the hall feeling really kind of miserable and uninspired, and we can listen to the Dhamma, and we can be really surprised at how uplifting it can be, or how helpful it has been to kind of set us straight again after we've kind of lost the plot for many weeks or many months, sometimes even years. You shouldn't despair if that's the case. I mean, that happens. That happens. So when you study Dhamma, it's I think it's really useful to consider it a commitment. Whether studying the suttas. Studying the suttas is, you know, the most pure form of studying the Dhamma. The suttas, while I think it's still an open question to me how much exactly is contained in the suttas that are exactly the word of the Buddha. You know, I just don't know. But I feel confident, and I think anybody who studied the scriptures, I mean, there's something special about the main truths that are communicated through the scriptures, and you get the sense that the entire canon possesses a certain kind of integrity, even if at times it's like it's got this kind of repetitive quality that seems, unlikely. One thing you can say about it is that 90% of the canon, if not 95%, if not 99%, the whole thing feels like an integrated whole. And it seems to be speaking the same basic message. There's an incredible consistency throughout the canon. And as the Buddha says, it has a taste. There's a certain taste that you get a sense for when you read the scriptures, and that's the taste of freedom. You sense that. You read, just whether it's just the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, or you sense the different... You sense that whatever energy or mind it was that went behind the words that are presented in the scriptures, it's a mind which wants people to... There's an energy that's communicated through those teachings that it's kind of shaping us to put forth effort and to strive to cultivate what is good, what is wholesome, what is beneficial for ourselves and others. It's like a hand, and our kind of hearts are like wax, and we expose ourselves to it, and we're shaped by it. And we're shaped in ways, I would suggest, that there can be no negative effect that would come from the teachings themselves. I mean, there can be a negative effect if you read them carelessly or you take them in the wrong way. So the Buddha says this teaching that we've all heard. So that right view, which is synonymous perhaps with many different levels of right view. Right view of the stream enterer. Right view of like the arahant, the fully enlightened one who's realized the nature of conditioned reality. But right view has two factors. One is the voice of another, that is to say the external teachings. And that's what I've been speaking of so far. And that's a condition, that's something that we have to expose ourselves to as part of the path. But the other factor, equally important, is the internal factor, and that's yoniso manasikara, or wise reflection. And that's just basically saying there is that there's not a formula that you can just simply take and sort of say, okay, I've got the right teachings now, I've got the right formula, so let me just plug into it and everything is going to compute properly and I'll get enlightened. It doesn't quite work like that. You actually have to apply your own wisdom. And you can't get around that. You actually have to take the teachings and be really very ruthlessly honest with yourself with regards to how you apply them, you know, with the sincerity with which you apply the teachings. And sometimes we can very easily... The mind is a very sad thing in so many ways, very fickle. And it's the way that we can deceive ourselves and justify various kinds of craving. The way that we create stories for ourselves and then believe a story, and then through having created a story and then believing in that story and letting it influence us, and then use that to justify something which may not be conditioning us in the best of ways. This is something I can see in myself very, very clearly, actually. And in some sense, it's sad. Sometimes you feel a bit kind of, can't believe that I'm still subject to these just a mind which just still tells itself stories. But then I'm also encouraged by the fact that I recognize that in myself. And I know that just to be able to recognize the way that we tend to do that, if you can recognize that in yourself, I think you've already, you know, that's no small feat. The fact that you're even recognizing your tendency to justify and to excuse what is unwholesome, the only way that you can do that is because there is something in your stream of consciousness which wants to be free of that tendency. So that's you shouldn't despair when you see that tendency or when you see the defilements within yourself. The only way that you can, when that happens, is because there's a part of you that wants to be free. And so that's very meaningful. So we're talking today. Today we had the Upasaka Day, and the topic was kind of roughly speaking the environment or nature. And quit different. You know, we were talking about helping, serving one of the things that kind of came up at once is how do you decide what to serve or how to make a difference in the world, maybe with regards to the environmental crisis or different political crisis happening or social difficulties in the world and so forth. And I can really sympathize with this question. I can understand how this can be difficult for people. And I've had to grapple with it myself. And I assume many of us here have. So like you think about the problem, different problems in the world, and you think about, well, isn't just like meditating, sitting on your cushion, or say becoming a monk or a nun, isn't that just like not helping the world? And what about you? You feel um, you feel you want to make a difference, and yet at the same time you're kind of drawn to the Buddhist teachings, and how do you kind of reconcile these different impulses? And I have to admit, it's a hard one. And I think in Buddhism, what we're recognizing in Buddhism is a certain truth of suffering that the Buddha speaks of. And this is a suffering of the heart, which goes very deep. And it's a suffering that's inherent in the human condition. It's not a suffering that's dependent on being, say, born in the wrong country, or being subject to certain illnesses, or subject to inequalities of various kinds. It's a very existential, fundamental kind of suffering, which basically says that force which animates our life, that craving which compels us to search for happiness in various forms, and it constantly leads us into new conditions, to the point, of course, in Buddhism, to the point of where there's rebirth. That's a problem that doesn't have a solution through simply fulfilling the craving. I spoke about this term that the Stoics have on the Thanksgiving retreat, hedonic adaptation. And it sounds kind of pompous, but it's a neat term. And hedonic is referring to, it comes from the word hedonism, or whatever the Greek equivalent of hedonism is. And it's referring to not so much the way we think of hedonism as like just pursuing sensual delight, but it's like just pursuing happiness. And it's like whenever you think something is going to give you some source of pleasure or happiness or well-being of any kind, let's say you think it's going to be like a new house or a new car, and you get the house, and at first it's great. You've got this new house. It's just lovely. It's exactly the kind of house you've always wanted. And then over time, that new house becomes... you become adapted to it. You become used to it, so much so that it becomes invisible, and it becomes like a baseline or a background to your experience. And suddenly, it's even though you've maybe saved up, for years and years and years, and kind of you put yourself in debt, and you've got this house now. It's great for a month, a year, whatever. But it doesn't matter how big it is. Eventually, it becomes invisible to you. And then that craving that compelled you to get the house in the first place then resurfaces, and it goes on to the next thing. Then it wants a new car or a bigger house. Or let's say some people, let's imagine somebody who says, yeah, well, you know what? I've got a big house and I've had it for 15, 20 years and I'm still really proud of it. Well, probably what's happening there is they are identifying with a certain kind of status, pride. And it's not so much about the house, but then they're kind of finding delight in this kind of status that they are, that they're better than others. But in time, even that, you become adapted to that, and then you start pursuing some other way to be better than others. And this is the way things can get absolutely obscene with the things that you pursue. I mentioned the example of the bankers. I mean, they make, sometimes it just seems to people who are just barely getting by in the world, obscene amounts of money, utterly obscene, millions and millions of dollars a year, and then they get for a Christmas bonus, like a $10 million bonus for Christmas. And it's like, how is that possible? And I think it's this process where it starts off small, and this is gradual adaptation to what seemed at once kind of special, but then you get used to it, and then suddenly what was only a $100,000 bonus, and both from your perspective and your boss's perspective, doesn't seem like that big a deal anymore. So it gets up, the ante gets kind of increased. So you get on this sort of hedonic treadmill, this constant movement of looking for something that is going to create a sense of satisfaction, only to find that whatever it is that you get becomes invisible. And again, I mentioned on the retreat, and I think that probably extends also to the human body. Although I certainly can't say I remember it clearly, but I can't remember being in the womb or anything like that, but I have a vague sense. I can almost remember the feeling, and I don't know if this is just projection into the past or if it speaks to anything that really comes from the past or not, but I have this vague sense of remembering what it was like, this sense of potential. Like you've got this whole, you just received a body, and you've got this sense of this whole future is laid out for you. You kind of, it's a good body, it's born in a kind of good environment, you've got a good family more or less, and you've got 80 years, if you're lucky, to just, you know, well, it's an open question what you're going to do with it, but it's like this incredible excitement and delight, and I think children that you have when you're born is kind of incredible potential. And at first, I assume, I think this is a safe assumption, it seems like an incredible thing to have received such a good body or a good situation. And it doesn't take long before maybe 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, but eventually you just take it for granted. It's who you are. And you've completely, it no longer means, you just assume that you somehow deserve it, or it's sort of like you were destined, it was fate or something. And of course it was never fate, it was a result of karma. So when we think about this, when we start reflecting that if the Buddha existed at all, and if he taught anything like the Four Noble Truths, if he was enlightened, and I'd like to propose that this is not in question. Of course, I'm speaking from a mind of faith. I'm one who has faith, so therefore I would say this. But I don't see it as being in question that the Buddha was fully enlightened. So what that means, basically, is that as we travel through rebirth, there's something that we have to come back to. We have to find our way to the Buddha and to his teachings. And it's not the case. It's not the case. And I don't think I'd like to suggest this. It's not the case that it doesn't matter, that everything is just going to be okay no matter what you do. That's not the case. Now, it may be the case on one level, that for some of us might have good karma enough that basically it's like we have so much barmi that certainly other people might think that we are going to be okay, and we might be okay simply based on our mountain of barmi that we're standing on. I mean, if that is the case. But life is a precarious situation, and with every step, we're either moving towards that still point, where the Buddha is seated, I'm speaking here metaphorically, where the Buddha is seated under the Bodhi tree, peacefully, wisely, having penetrated the nature of existence. We're either moving towards that refuge with every step, with every choice we make, or we're moving away from it. And I think a lot of people, we're very happy to simply create in our mind a narrative that we're going to believe in. And let us believe, we often think to ourselves, let me just believe in this narrative long enough so that, like at the point of death, I can still believe in this narrative. But of course, what we find is that the narrative is only, it's only the narrative that we've told ourselves while we were alive. And once we're dead, there is a reality at play here that we're subject to. whether we like it or not. There's the reality is out there. Certain truths are there that are dictating the way the world turns. And we can't, it's not just up to us to simply create a narrative and believe it. And how is it that these narratives come about? And they come about through a gradual assent, a gradual saying yes to what we want to believe rather than to what actually is. And the difficulties that we encounter on the path, every time that we suffer, every time we feel a sense of disconnect, every time we feel our faith is shaken, that means we've picked up something wrong in the first place. And we have to reorient our understanding. And sometimes that reorientation has to be, you know, very thorough. Maybe we've picked up something fundamentally wrong. Maybe we've been holding it for years, decades maybe. But if we come across suffering, it means there's something we have to change. We have to turn the way we've been holding the whole game. And we have to be willing to do that. The narratives we tell ourselves, I mean, you know, there's this instance of the Buddha, Brahmajala Sutta, I think it's called, the net of views, where the Buddha goes through all these different views. I mean, all the different, what he says is the complete, or what's in the texts, all the possible views that can exist in the world. You know, and he says there's 64, I think, or 62, I can't remember. And he covers all these different cases. Many of them seem very similar, and some of them seem very unlikely to us. But it basically covers all the possible views. And then the Buddha wraps it up, and he just pulls the carpet out from underneath the feet of all of them. He says that any of these views would arise without contact. I say that is not possible. That's it. You think about that. He's not even saying they're wrong. Well, I don't think he's even saying they're wrong in that particular discourse as such. He's just saying basically every one of these views, they arise from contact. And it's like you're given in a certain situation, you have sense contact, including the mind sense. You're born into a culture and you have different kinds of contact. You're told to believe different things, and you assent to different. You basically create your views and your beliefs, and you do it bit by bit, step by step, until you wind up with over the years you wind up with a belief that you're committed to, and actually that belief simply it was a gradual evolution. Because you allowed the craving process to guide your thinking process. And yet at the same time, we still, you know, you expose yourself to what seem to be the true teachings, and you apply the wisdom that you have to understand them and to practice accordingly. And then still sometimes you come up with perceptions that it just simply seems that something has to be done. Done in life. And I'm reminded now of this passage from, from Socrates, when Socrates, you know, everyone knows the story of Socrates. He was this incredibly virtuous, wise man in Athens, 500 BC. And he used to kind of prod people and challenge people and basically make people look like fools, even though he wasn't. Well, actually, I think he was trying to make it look like fools. But he kind of made it look as if he was just, he did it in a kind of ironic way. He was just trying to explore, like, well, you say you know about such and such. And he goes, well, tell me, do you really know about, you know, what poetry is or something like that? And get them talking. And eventually he found out that basically nobody really knew anything. Nobody, so many people said that they were wise and they all turned out not to be. And he made a lot of kind of, he irritated a lot of people, so much so he made some enemies, and they said that he was corrupting the youth because all the young seemed to admire him, And they would, you know, he challenged the conventions and the religions of the time. And so they convicted him of being guilty of corrupting the youth. And they put it to a jury. It was 500 and some people in the jury. It was a democracy, and they kind of, many of the citizens voted, the male citizens at least. And he was found guilty, something like 300 to 200, I can't remember the number, but it wasn't by any means just half and half. It was like a good size thought he was innocent, a good proportion thought he was innocent, but just a few more thought he was guilty. And as Kachana reminded me just the other day, what the court then asked him, they said, okay, Socrates, now you can if you'd like to propose a penalty, a punishment, please do so. And he said, well, basically I propose that's what I've been doing all these years, living on the streets, and I've been really teaching virtue to the people and teaching them to be wise. So I think what you should do is you should set me up for life, basically, and take care of me. And you know, and then his prosecutors, of course, they said that his main enemies proposed death. So when Socrates suggested this, and he knew that the court would never they would never agree to that, so he was basically what he was saying is, okay, give me death. You know, if this city is such that it's it sees me as a corrupter of the youth, then basically give me death, is pretty much what he's saying. And so death it is. His sentence is like something like, at a certain time on a certain day, there's some poison, you've got to drink the poison. And of course, everyone who met Socrates, he had many disciples, you know, Plato was one of them, and Cicero, all these different kind of names that some of us may have heard of if you studied history or Greek history. Greek philosophy. And the guards loved, you know, they were guarding him, and the guards kind of said, you know, Socrates, I think there's a way, you know, I think we'll let you escape essentially tonight if you like. And Socrates would say, no, it's, you know, I've part of the city served me well, and if this city finds that I should be condemned to death, then to death I shall surrender. And here I'm getting to the point of the story. Eventually, let's say that there was a time, I can't remember the time, if it was like something like later on at night, or if it was at sunset, that Socrates was supposed to drink the poison. But let's say sunset. He was supposed to drink the poison at sunset. And before then, like let's say at like 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, Socrates says, you know, he's talking it over with his disciples and says, well, is there any questions and any last words? And there's kind of silence, and he says, well, then, bring me the poison. And one of his disciples says, Socrates, you know, it's not even time yet. It's you have another couple hours. You don't have to drink the poison yet. I mean, everyone else, when they do this, they wait to the last possible minute. And here's the point I'm getting to. Is he says, and they did right in doing so, for they thought they would gain something by it. Whereas for me, I would only make myself foolish in my own eyes. So bring me the poison. And he drank it very cheerfully. And his last words were, he reminded one of his disciples to make sure he paid back a certain amount of money that he owed to somebody. Those were his last words. And then I think the letter ends. I think it was Plato's letter, and it ends here died the most generous, the most beautiful, and the most noble man I have ever met. So the point is that I was very moved by the way that Socrates, you know, rather than kind of call them fools for waiting to the last possible minute to extend life, which is basically, has for all practical purposes already ended. He says, no, they did right because they thought that they were gaining something thereby. And I think that's fair enough. We have to work off that principle that when we believe something to be right, when in the bottom of our souls we've searched, we've done the homework, as it were, and it's not because we're avoiding truth, and we can honestly say that to ourselves, we're not avoiding truth, we really recognize that this is something that I perceive to be right. What else can you do? I mean, you can't to simply force yourself to go against that because of some rule or because someone comes along and tells you that it's not the wise thing to do. That would be self-betrayal. And that's not the path either. So we have to, you know, it's a very, there's this image that, it's actually not in the, as far as I know, as far as I know, it's not in the Theravadin canon, about the razor's edge. The name of a movie, I remember. But the whole point of this image is like walking the spiritual path. It's like walking on the razor's edge because it's a very narrow path. Narrow in the sense that it's easy to fall into one of the extremes extremes that we could fall into. The extremes of, say, existence or the extremes of non-existence. Fall into the delusion where it'd be so nice, wouldn't it, if we could convince ourselves that this whole human project and story were in the hands of some higher power, or that some higher power was just going to come along and save me. What a relief that would be. But of course, I can't accept something like that. Or what a relief even it would be if I could just believe that after death there was nothing. You know, just you die and then that's it. Believe me, that would be a relief as well. and that would be a great relief. But there's no way around it. There's no way around the fact, for me, that I have to take responsibility for the fact that I know in my heart that the Buddhist teachings, lead to liberation, and I can't see any other goal which is worth pursuing other than liberation. And there's no one else who can walk the path but myself, for myself. And it's just, there's no other way to do it. So we walk the path. We do our best. We cultivate the path to the best of our ability. And sometimes we speak in terms to make it sound like life is negative, like we talk about the suffering of the world or the impermanence of life. And all that's very true. But the purpose of all of that is to be free. It's not to get negative. And, you know, just it's just such a, to me, we can come back, I find a good way to cut through the views that we have. Earlier I spoke about how views are conditioned through contact. A way to cut through the views is to come back to the senses, you know, these six senses, and be mindful simply now and how the world is experienced at the sense basis. And you don't have to have a view around that. You don't have to come up to any kind of view like I exist or the world exists or anything like that. You just recognize there's this sense contact taking place now. And I find a real freedom in that. Now it's tiring because you have to come back to that again and again, and you have to overcome the views that arise, that give you the narrative, the stories that you tell yourself. You've got to cut through that and come back to, okay, well, this is a story. This is a thought. This is just sight. This is just beauty. That's all it is, and it's going to be an experience and it's going to pass away. But even that, you don't have to say that. You just come back to the experience of the senses in the present moment, and that cuts through the views and the stories. So just in, to sum up, just to, I think I'd like to encourage all of us to be cognizant of what a remarkable situation we're in. And, you know, it's incredible. This world, there's conflict all over the world, and there's people taking advantage of other people everywhere. And that's not trying to be negative. That's the way it is. And we could have been born in like a prison state in Palestine. We could have been born in the Congo. Or in this very life, we could, if we don't proceed with caution, with wisdom, not paranoia, not fear, but just with wisdom and caution, and recognize the vulnerability of our condition and the responsibility we have to play in shaping it, it gives rise to a sense of urgency and a sense of compassion for the human condition, a sense of there's nothing special about me because we're all in the same boat in one sense. And in that sense, there's a real sense of connection with all beings. I mean, sympathy with beings who are hopefully in all kinds of different conditions. I would like to think that I can have some capacity to put myself in their shoes. So yeah, be cognizant of the good fortune that we have, and take it to heart, and let's take it and use it for our practice, and trust that in that good karma, that's profoundly good karma, and in that good karma there can only be good results. The Buddha says that for one who has faith in the highest, the highest results of action will be theirs. So I offer that for your reflection this evening.